Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Full Bio is our book series when we fully explore a deeply researched biography over the course of a week, day by day, so we can get into the details. This week we are discussing Led Zeppelin, the biography by Bob Spitz. Today we'll hear about the band at the height of its success and the depths of the members' behavior. Led Zeppelin was prolific. In the early years, they released four albums between 1969 and 1972, and they went upon tour upon tour. There were the usual trappings, riders that required fresh fruit and certain lighting. They spent lavishly and made so much money they would carry around $200,000 and $300,000 in cash. Their team skirted taxes, paid off people, so the band could do what it wanted. And they got what it wanted. Except when it came to the press, who they hated and had a list of rules posted backstage should a journalist gain access. Bob Spitz writes in his book, "Anyone from the rock press or print media who was invited to accompany the Led Zeppelin Roadshow received a printed form that laid out the ground rules. Never talk to anyone in the band unless they first talk to you. Number two, do not make any sort of eye contact with John Bonham. This is for your own safety. Three, do not talk to Peter Grant or Richard Cole for any reason. Four, keep your cassette player turned off at all times unless conducting an interview. Five, never ask questions about anything other than music. Six, most important, understand this. The band will read what is written about them. The band does not like the press, nor do they trust them." Here's today's full bio on Led Zeppelin with author Bob Spitz. Let's start today's conversation with a little bit about how Led Zeppelin did business, because I found this part of the book particularly fascinating. That first of all, they hated the press and they wouldn't even talk to the press. Yeah. Was there a method to the madness?
No, not really. Eventually that did them in. I think that's where they had their biggest problem. That whole feeling came because they got a really lousy review in Rolling Stone for their first album. It was, you know, an older 1960s style of critic who just didn't have any feeling for Led Zeppelin. And he let them know that in his review. So they decided that the press were enemies at that point. And of course, they were in a lot of ways. The American press was really controlled by, you know, people in their late 20s and early 30s who had been in rock and roll and in college in the 60s. And they loved the 60s music. They loved, you know, James Taylor and Crosby, Stills and Nash and Joni Mitchell. And of course, the Beatles and the Stones. They didn't hear this new sound that Jimmy Page had in his head, and they weren't going to sit still for it. They thought, oh, it's noise. It's for teeny boppers. And of course it was. It was for the next generation of teenagers who had come up behind them. And rock and roll is, you know, it's a teenage music. All great music is a threat, and it threatened those critics. And so they were going to let Led Zeppelin have it, and Led Zeppelin let them have it right back. They decided, we're not going to cooperate with the press. We're going to treat them badly. As I said when I started talking about it, was that eventually it did them in. They craved the press. They couldn't understand why the Rolling Stones, who were selling one quarter of the records that Led Zeppelin were selling, got so much press and they got nothing. And it was because of their attitude and the way they treated the press. And so, you know, there was a real kind of attitude that they had with him, and it really did not pay off for them in the end.
Led Zeppelin did not want to release singles. What was the thought process behind it?
Simple. They felt that all they had to do was have people on the radio say there was a new Led Zeppelin album out, and kids would rush out and buy that album, sight unseen. Why give them the opportunity to spend $1.25 on a single when we can get them, if there were no singles available, we can get them to spend $7.99 or $9.99 on an album? You know, kind of pirate thinking, but it was Led Zeppelin's thinking. And so they didn't want to have singles put out. Also, Jimmy his music was long and drawn out, and he didn't want his songs edited down to 2.5 minutes. And so very early on, they just decided no singles, and they stuck by it throughout their entire career.
I was surprised, and maybe this is more about my ignorance, is how much control they had, and that they were a bit control freakish about cover art, about any way they would be portrayed, about not reducing Stairway to Heaven to a 3:24 cut, as radio promoters were begging them to do. How did they get so much control?
Well, you know, in the early days, with the emergence of what we called supergroups, and Led Zeppelin was really sold to record companies as a supergroup, they had all the leverage when they made a deal. They knew these record companies wanted them badly. And so Jimmy Page and Peter Grant, when they made their deal at Atlantic, made a deal that gave them control of everything, over their albums, what goes on it, what they would look like, how many would be pressed, everything, what kind of albums they would make. And the fact that they wouldn't make a live album, it was a remarkable deal. I'm shocked that any record company would give artists like that kind of power. But they did, and Led Zeppelin wielded it. They also did things like they wouldn't let kids take pictures of them in concert. God knows why. But if they saw anybody with a camera, they didn't just take that camera out of their hands. They would have one of their goons take the camera, smash the camera, and maybe give the kids a shot or two as well. It was part of Peter Grant's thuggish behavior, and it kind of bled into all areas of Led Zeppelin's control over things. But you did mention they had control of their cover art. And this was really, Allison, at the very beginning of covers meanings, having real meaning, mm-hmm. and being very artistic. That was never the case until Sgt. Pepper's came out. In the old days, the record companies demanded that they just have a picture of the group on the cover, and they'd slap some typeface on. Their graphic design departments were, you know, people in their 60s who had no feel for rock and roll. But Sgt. Pepper's changed all that. And just 4 years later, when, you know, Led Zeppelin really starts to wield control over everything, they decide that their covers are going to be spectacular. And it didn't matter what they cost. And because they had control over it, their covers would be just incredible works of art. And they often cost a fortune to produce, $10,000 sometimes.
On today's Full Bio, we're discussing the book Led Zeppelin by Bob Spitz. So, Bob, you know, they released, I believe it was 4 albums in 2 years, mm-hmm. from the time they started to about 1971, 72. What was behind them being so prolific?
Wow. It's like all terrific artists when they're first starting out. Bob Dylan did the same thing. They couldn't control themselves. I mean, mm-hmm. I remember when I was writing Dylan's biography, somebody told me they had walked uptown with him in New York from the Village to, say, Midtown. And by the time they got up there, Dylan had songs pouring out of him. He was writing them down on paper as fast as he could, as fast as he could write. The same thing happened with Led Zeppelin. In the early days, Jimmy was writing like mad, just couldn't stop. And so the minute they had an album out, they decided they'd put more product out because there were just so many songs that kept coming and coming and coming. Also, the record companies were really demanding in those days. They wanted two albums at minimum from an artist every year, usually around the holidays and then, you know, around spring as well. And so they put pressure on the groups as well. And Led Zeppelin complied. I mean, they had a lot of material. Jimmy loved being in the studio. He felt at home there. And so Led Zeppelin, as you said, put out four albums in a year and a half, a ton of product.
Robert Plant considered Led Zeppelin III the best album they ever made. That's what she's writing about in the book. What was special about the way this album was made and the end result?
Well, they had been on the road for roughly a year when, and they didn't even know where they were anymore. That was a brutal brutal couple tours that had been strung together, and so they wanted to get off the road for a while. And Robert had his family had a cabin just on the Welsh border that they would go to. And he said to Jimmy, let's just go up there. There's no electricity. There's no nothing. It'll just be the two of us and maybe a roadie or two to take care of us. And we'll put some music together. And they did. They put together this kind of bucolic album of that drew on traditional music, quite a bit of traditional music. And in fact, they attached their cables to it and they rocked it up a bit. But there was a lot of the traditional roots that seeped into it. And it befuddled, I would say, most of the fans. They wanted another album with a whole lot of love on it. They wanted everything cranked up to 14, and they didn't get it. So while Robert thought that that was one of his favorite albums, the fans were very cool to it, as were the critics.
I'm curious about something you said about the tour being grueling. They toured a lot. Seems like they didn't love it so much, even though they swathed themselves in luxury on the road. They had their own plane. They had their every whim catered to. What was the issue?
Well, you know, look, I had been on the road with Bruce Springsteen and Elton John in the 70s, and I knew what the issue was. It doesn't matter how much luxury you have. It takes everything out of you. It's a different city every day, a hotel room that's basically that makes you anonymous. And after a while, you just feel like you're living in a bubble. But it's not a pretty bubble. It's really nerve-wracking. And then you've got to get to the gig. You play a set. Your adrenaline goes way up. You finish about 11 o'clock at night. Your adrenaline doesn't come down till 3 o'clock in the morning. You go to sleep. People knock on your door at 9 in the morning and get you up to do interviews again and get to the next gig, travel time, go to the airport, get your equipment there. Oh, man, after a while, you do that for a couple of months. It is really hard on the psyche. And so I appreciated it. But, you know, Led Zeppelin were also prima donnas, and they did take care of themselves well on the road. There were planes that were private planes loaded with champagne and caviar and every drug of their choice. And young women, let's not leave them out. It's hard for those of us mortals to understand how that isn't a wonderful place to be, but it's not, and it plays on your psyche, and it made them grouchy.
Each man dealt with fame differently. Jimmy Page became increasingly interested in the occult.
What was behind this fascination? And he believed it helped him somehow. How?
Jimmy Page was a disturbed little boy. He said that he started reading about the occult when he was 11 years old. And he read the books written by Aleister Crowley, who was like the father of black magic and occultism in the UK. Look, you know, if you're a lonely kid, and Jimmy was in those days, he was an only child. He didn't have many friends. So he turned to these writings, and they influenced him greatly. And, you know, one of the things that Crowley wrote was his credo was, do what thou wilt. And for an 11-year-old kid, and then a 15-year-old kid, and then a 20-year-old rock star, do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law, is, you know, a license to be and do whatever you want, to be whoever you want. Don't worry about, you know, the repercussions. And that was Jimmy's whole life in those days. I mean, he just did anything he wanted to do and felt it was okay. And because he was a rock star, because everything came his way, he got away with it. And he never forgot, do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law.
That belief system, do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law, would take the band and the people who came in contact with the members to dark, dangerous, and sometimes violent places. We'll have more with Bob Spitz after the break. This is All of It. This is All of It. We continue our conversation about Full Bio, Led Zeppelin, the full biography, with Bob Spitz. We've arrived at a part of a conversation that requires a trigger warning and may require headphones, as our conversation will include a discussion of statutory rape and sexual assault. Remember, if you or anyone you know needs help, the National Sexual Assault Hotline, RAIN, is 1-800-656-4673. The members of Led Zeppelin engaged in sexual behavior that ranged from flirting to abuse. Members of the band had sex with underage girls, which today falls under the definition of statutory rape, which is defined as, quote, sexual intercourse with a person who has not yet reached the age of consent determined by state law, whether or not the sexual act is against that person's will. Sometimes these young girls came to the band's hotel on their own. Sometimes they were recruited by management, and unbelievably, sometimes their mothers brought them. John Bonham, the drummer, could be abusive to anybody, but particularly towards women, once in a drunken rage, ripping the clothes off a female reporter. You may remember that Bob Spitz was scheduled to interview the band for this book. Then #MeToo happened, and the lawyer shut down the interviews. For Spitz, the husband of a woman he describes as a feminist and the father of a daughter, it was a challenge to write about this part of the band's history, a challenge he took seriously and does so unflinchingly with great detail. Here's the rest of today's full bio. These men in Led Zeppelin led somewhat double lives. They had wives and children at home, but they had women and girls, young underage girls, in cities in the United States. And I think, to be honest, that some of the behavior that Led Zeppelin engaged in would probably have them thrown in jail now, not just ostracized for their behavior. They'd be in an R. Kelly kind of situation.
I can tell you, when I went to the UK one time to do some research, I went through customs and was stopped by one of the customs officers, a woman. And she said to me, it says on your passport that you're a biographer. And I said, that's right. And she said, what are you here for? And I said, I'm Led Zeppelin's biographer. And she said, is it a good story? And I looked her right in the eye and I said, if you think it's a good story, if you think a 28-year-old man should be in bed with a 12-year-old, it's a good story. Now, it's shocking. But those girls and my wife, who was an ardent feminist, said, don't you dare call them young women. They were girls. They were 12 and 14 years old, way below the age of consent. Yes, they were everywhere on the road. And yes, Led Zeppelin was involved with them in many different ways.
Has Jimmy Page ever spoken about this or addressed this?
Not in the least. It's something that's not talked about. Nobody has paid the piper for this. I talked to a lot of these women who had been involved with Led Zeppelin when they were 14 and 15 years old. Now they're in their early 60s. And to try to understand, you know, what those relationships were all about. And it's really hard. I mean, I'm the father of a daughter and of a young woman. And for me, it's even harder. There's no explaining it. I mean, there's really, did these young girls throw themselves at the band? Yes, they did. But when a 12 and 14 year old throws themselves at you, you have to be mature enough to say, I'm not getting involved in this. And I had just spent 8.5 years writing about the Beatles. The Beatles had so many of these young girls thrown at them too, but they didn't get involved. All the Beatles women that they got involved with were age appropriate. So this, when this confronted me while I was writing the book, it gave me pause. And I spent a long time trying to figure out how I was going to present this to the reading public and the impact that it would have. And I tried not to shy away from it, but I also didn't want it to overpower the book.
Yeah, I was going to actually compliment you on providing a lot of detail in the book in a very, as objective a way as you could. Some things you can't be objective about, clearly.
Right.
You know,
right.
John Bonham treated women particularly violently and in misogynistic acts, which we won't talk about on the air, yet they had these, they would pine for their wives and their children. Specifically, John Bonham wanted to be home. He didn't particularly like touring.
Yeah, well, I mean, John Bonham was a big baby. You know, mm-hmm. People who were close to him and management of the band said to me, John Bonham was a 25-year-old man. He was a 12-year-old boy in the body of a 25-year-old man. And I think that hits it right on the head, you know. Never grew up. And Jimmy didn't treat these girls very well either. I mean, you know, somebody who was on the road with them all the time said, we never thought of these girls as sentient creatures. I mean, whoa, did that take my breath away when I heard that? So it was a strange time. I mean, I don't know that the times have changed all that much with rock and roll bands, but I like to think that the next couple generations of young girls that grew up in this culture had more self-esteem and knew how to control at least their position in those relationships.
My guest is Bob Spitz. We're talking about his book, Led Zeppelin. It's our choice for full bio. You know, we've been talking so much about their behavior. What was the music like at this time, at the height of their popularity, and how did this, we'll talk about drugs in a minute, but let's just talk about the music for a second.
Sure.
What was the music like at this time? Were they at their creative peak when they were their most successful, or did those two things not coincide?
Oh, I think they were at their creative peak when they were the most successful. They, I think they got better and better and better as they went on. And for me, it was a particular revelation because I have 20,000 vinyl albums in my collection. And when I started this book, I will be honest with you. I'll tell you, I didn't have a single Led Zeppelin album. And if you had asked me to name a couple of their songs, I might have been able to name Whole Lotta Love and Stairway to Heaven, but that's it. I didn't know their music. And so I was in such a wonderful position of sitting down for 2 years and just listening to the progression of their music and letting it seep in and understanding this incredible catalog of music that they left us with. And they got better and better and better because they were out there on the road. They were, you know, honing their craft. They were becoming comfortable with each other, and they were comfortable with each other. And that made them play better and be more creative. And so I think you can see a progression all the way through their albums, even until the very end. And of course, as you mentioned just a second ago, drugs come into it at a certain point. And I think that's when things began to change.
When did drugs really start to become a problem? All bands on the road have recreational behaviors. But it seems, in reading the book, this just seemed to spiral into darkness.
Yeah, here was the difference, Allison. I think that in the 60s, the bands got creative with the use of drugs because they were basically dealing with marijuana and at times LSD, which is mind expanding. By the time Led Zeppelin comes into their own, we're not dealing with marijuana and LSD anymore. We're into the cocaine years and then the heroin years. And I think that's really, the music is so much more aggressive. And it's, as you said earlier, it's louder and it changes completely. And so drugs gave the music a different shade, but also started to interfere with the lives of the bands because you can't go on very long on a diet of cocaine or heroin. It catches up with you and it becomes very evident, not only in your life, but in the music as well.
What's an example of a song that you think, sound-wise and sort of tone-wise, reflects that the dependence and the sort of the infection of drug use?
Yeah, I think even more than a particular song, albums 5, 6, 7, right around there, their music starts to go off the rails a little. It gets a little louder, not as creative. They're not working in harmony anymore. The sessions are kind of fractured. Jimmy doesn't show up until the very end, leaves the others sitting around waiting for him. The same with John Bonham. And I think you hear it in at least the last three albums that they made, and it changes the sound of the music.
It also changes the tone of their shows, their concerts. The events take on a certain darkness, even a kind of violent sort of shadowing around the whole events. What was leading to this aura around their shows?
Well, you know, the kids got involved with cocaine as well, and not just the guys on stage. And so there was a lot of aggression in those arenas before Led Zeppelin even came on. It was just a feeling and the anticipation. And, you know, Led Zeppelin would often be an hour and a half late. So the kids would just, they would, you know, do drugs. They would drink like crazy. There was a lot of fury on the floor of the arenas before the band got on. And then the band comes on and they're allowed and they are, the whole arena shakes and thumps. And all of this just kind of grows and grows. And it's like a slow build to it and that just bursts when they come on stage. And it gets crazy. You know, the kids start bringing firecrackers to the show and smoke bombs. The cops are waiting for them. They can see the cops on the perimeters just waiting for something to happen to rush in to stop it. And violence erupts. The band often on stage, to their credit, tried to calm the kids down. But there was no calming the kids down at that point. And so the concerts became an event of a different kind. It wasn't just the music and the explosion of sound coursing through you anymore. it was a lot of what was happening on the floor of the arena as well. And that just never pays off dividends.
A lot of times money can solve a problem. In this case, how did money exacerbate the problems Led Zeppelin was dealing with?
Well, they had so much money, and they made sure that they got paid in cash a lot of the times, that a lot of the money went to cocaine. There were bagfuls of it on their plane, in the cars, in the hotel rooms. And it was consumed in proportions that nobody had ever seen before. And so the money, you know, the money really, it did. It changed everything. They had no regard for how much money they made anymore. At one point, there was a robbery at the Drake Hotel where $200,000 of cash of theirs was taken out of the safe deposit box and disappeared. And the guys laughed it off. I mean, they had gotten to that point where $200,000 didn't affect them anymore. So, you know, it, you lose reality, and they lost reality. And I think, you know, the fact that they were together for 10 years and that they had held it together for so long was a minor miracle.
That was today's full bio about Led Zeppelin, the biography by Bob Spitz. Tomorrow we'll finish with the end of the band as a quartet.
NYC Now delivers breaking news, top headlines, and in-depth coverage from WNYC and Gothamist every morning, midday, and evening. By sponsoring our programming, you'll reach a community of passionate listeners in an uncluttered audio experience. Visit sponsorship.wnyc.org to learn more.